It's Byline on WFPL News. I'm Gabe Bullard. For the past few weeks, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher has been pushing for a change in state law that would allow county voters to choose whether to temporarily raise the sales tax to pay for specific improvements, such as crime labs or public transit. Many other cities have this. For instance, Oklahoma City has raised nearly $1 billion in the last 2 decades through a local option sales tax, but the concept has its opponents. To discuss the issue, I'm here with WFPL political editor Philip Bailey, Carmen Hickerson from GLI, and on the phone is Representative Steve Riggs of Louisville, co-chair of the Local Government Committee. Thanks for being here, everyone.
Hey, Gabe.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Gabe.
All right. Philip, I'll start with you. The city certainly could use some extra revenue.
Yeah, given over the past few years, the deficits that the city has faced, additional revenue is something that, you know, city leaders look for across the country. I mean, cities really are at the crunch of all this, especially now that stimulus money has run out, is no longer available. You know, the federal government makes cuts, pass it on to the state. States makes cut, pass it on to the city. So we talk about Louisville, we've obviously have some other financial issues, the structural imbalance and the firefighter settlement. So, you know, Mayor Fisher coming into office certainly has thought about and talked about additional revenue, new revenue, outside the norm of raising the taxes that are already in place.
And Carmen, GLI supports the idea of a local option?
Well, I think I'd like to frame up the conversation not so much about creating new revenue as much as about how important it is to think about what we want our city to be. What is the vision that we have for Louisville going forward? And what are the projects or the programs that we would like to see happen that over the years we haven't been able to do because the money hasn't been there? I'd also like to say that the way that the local option sales tax works normally is that it doesn't just go into a general fund. It's not just a matter of just raising additional revenue. It is generally tied to a specific project or projects, and that is approved by voters on a local referendum. And if they don't buy into that vision and they don't buy into what those projects are, then it doesn't pass. But 88 out of 100 communities of the largest cities in the country use this tax, and we see example after example of cities that have been able to transform themselves and really create the kind of place that people want to live and work by utilizing a tax like this.
Is this the best way to turn Louisville into the sort of city that would be the most attractive to new residents and businesses?
I think it's a big piece of the whole. You know, we at the Chamber and also leading economic development for the city, we see our competitor cities who are able to put these quality of life things into place. And these days, the economic development game is really about the challenge to get talent. It's where people want to live. And companies will locate where there are people who are ready to work, an educated workforce. And talent looks for quality of life. And they want those civic amenities that attribute to that quality of life. And this is one way that we can add to our portfolio of what we have and what we know to be a great quality of life here in Louisville.
And this would come through the sales tax, which is often criticized, though, as being a regressive tax. It's something that's taxing consumption that's going to hurt low-income residents more. Why not just raise other taxes in the city that maybe are not quite as regressive?
Well, the Kentucky Constitution is fairly limiting to what cities can use in terms of raising revenue. And we are over-reliant on the occupational tax, which is essentially a personal income tax at the local level. We are already extremely high when compared to our competitive cities on that tax. So when you add the 6% personal income tax for the state and the 2.2 in Louisville, that puts us at the very top tier of our competitor cities. In addition, when you have when you're trying to attract that talent and you have a very high personal income-based tax, those two things work against each other. When you compare us to our competitor cities on the sales tax, there's room in there. And even if we were to enact as much of as a penny as a local option sales tax, we would still be somewhere in the middle of our competitive set.
And politically, that's a chief concern, particularly among Republicans, is that you already have the occupational tax, you have the property tax here in Jefferson County, you have the health insurance premium tax. So the question is that going to add something that's already in place to more taxes? Because as Ms. Hickerson pointed out, I mean, of the 100 top cities, 88, has been the number that I've heard. You see that the local sales tax option is there, but the difference is that some of those other cities don't have other taxes. For example, Nashville because the state of Tennessee doesn't have an income tax, there's a tax that's taken away. So the resistance to this politically is really the question that comes down to it at this point. Is it politically feasible for a local sales tax option to be on the table when you have a situation to where this would have to be passed by the General Assembly, voted on by the entire state, even if it was just applied to Jefferson County or Fayette County? People from other parts of the state would have a say-so, and they may not buy into that idea that the Louisville mayor has.
And Representative Riggs, I want to bring you into this conversation, since it would have to clear the General Assembly. What are the odds of that?
Well, they did mention these other cities that have a local referendum, and quite a few do, but they're not in Kentucky. Kentucky's constitution prohibits this. So the political wall that you would have to climb, and a wall without any ladders, would be very, very difficult here in Kentucky. I think a better approach than having a new tax would be one to try to put together a program in which you get more of the tax dollars you've already sent to Frankfort back to use in your local community. That we've talked about that, but that's never really been organized. It's in the beginning of conversations between metropolitan mayors, but there's never really been a structure to go to sit down with the governor and to go sit with the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate and say, we send too much money there, we don't get our fair share back. Let's get some of that back.
Right, this is a complaint we've heard a lot in Louisville. What is it, about 50 cents on the dollar comes back to Louisville?
Give credit to Mayor Fisher for launching into this and igniting this conversation that really started the mayoral campaign back in 2010, which was the complaint from many Republicans and Democrats in the city alike, is that we see our tax dollars here in Louisville, which is the economic engine for the state, going to sparsely populated parts and rural parts of the state. Why aren't we seeing more of that tax dollar come back? So the idea of where is the revenue that we already have in place, is it being used wisely enough? This was a criticism during the library tax referendum debate back in 2007. That was different, obviously, because state law gives cities the right to create specific service districts, like a fire district tax. So that's very different than this conversation. But still, the underlying argument from opponents of the library tax was, are you using the money that's already in place adequately enough? Why levy a new tax altogether? But certainly, I think, as Ms. Hickerson's pointed out, this is something that other competitive cities, the vast majority of other competitive cities, have. The difference is that those other competitive cities are not in a state. Kentucky is one of the few states that does not allow a local sales tax option.
Right. We have a constitutional amendment prohibiting it. So while we can look at the other cities and say they do it, they didn't have this political wall to climb of a constitutional amendment, which you only get a crack at those maybe once or twice per session. Very, very difficult to do. I do find it interesting that so many conservative leaders in Kentucky are interested in this new potential sales tax, because I've seen the conservative columnist in the newspaper sort of defend it. I have seen the chamber leaders that are intrigued by the idea. And actually, this is not a new idea. There was a piece of legislation in 2008 that was proposed to do this. It didn't get much media coverage. It was a Lexington area legislator who did it. It was assigned to the Elections and Constitutional Amendments Committee. It was heard, but it was never voted on because it didn't have enough support, if any support, to be voted on. And then before 2008 and 2006, there was a task force when Governor Fletcher was there, you know, our last Republican governor, and that task force, in his report, said that part of the Constitution, it's actually Section 181, probably needs to be, I think the wording was changed or altered in order to give cities this kind of idea to work on.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of things not passing, and Philip, you mentioned the library tax as well, the failed referendum a few years back. What is the hope, actually, that if the local option goes through in the situation that the Constitution would be changed, the state Constitution, what are the odds that some of these local referendums could end up passing?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I think that's the real question. It depends on what the local sales tax option, what the focus would be. Would it be public transit? Would it be, as the mayor said, a forensics lab? Would it be the libraries? That honestly might depend upon the political will and the push of each particular campaign.
Mm-hmm. I think Representative Riggs is accurate in saying that making a change to the Constitution is not an easy task. But I think that the message really, I mean, this is a multi-step process. And the first step in the process is for the legislature to allow it to be put on the ballot on a statewide basis. And then there would be a statewide ballot initiative to change the Constitution to allow it. Then there would be a decision made, whether it be a group of community leaders or if the mayor convenes a group of people around talking about what we want that vision to be and what those projects would be. And then there would be a local referendum. And I think that what it really comes down to is give the people a choice, give the people the opportunity to say what they're interested in. And I think that we feel like that the beginning part of this discussion about putting it on the ballot, let us at least have the option to do it. Let's at least change the Constitution and allow us to have the option to do it. And from there, every citizen has the right to voice how they feel about it.
And we see, once again, the consistent tension between Louisville and Kentucky, the city and the state. And for many, the question is, and I don't know if the tax commission has commented on it publicly, but former Mayor Jerry Abramson is now lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. He's the one running this blue ribbon commission. So there are some who are wondering if the political pressure from Louisville is enough to force the state legislature to allow this to be on the ballot in the first place. You have already seen Mayor Fisher come out for it publicly. I'm not sure how much he's lobbied the Jefferson County delegation. Some have been critical of it, like State Senator Julie Denton, who's a member of the Jefferson County delegation. So I don't know how much pressure and lobbying efforts the mayor's office has put into it, but there hasn't really been a political strategy that's been put out by the mayor other than him saying, well, I want this local sales tax option. There's no vote count. There's been no question of is Lieutenant Governor Abramson in behind this,
right?
And is he lobbying for the effort? So while everyone's talking about it, there's been no political calculus put out there for the public to consume to say, is this even feasible to climb that wall in the first place?
Well, you know, the idea that Governor Fletcher said that we need a more flexible tax structure in that task force in 2006, and this very same bill, well, close to it anyway, it didn't have any cap to it, but didn't get any play in 2008. What has changed between then and now to make anyone think that this has better than a,
right,
than a 1% chance?
And is we just have 1 minute here, but is GLI planning any sort of legislative push?
This is a priority for our organization. It's a priority for our community, and I think you will see us talking very actively, not only with the legislature, but with the citizens. And I think that once people understand what it is and how it works and what the possibilities are, if you had something like this in place, we believe that people will get behind the ideas they have in other communities.
All right, and that's all the time we have for this discussion. Thanks for being here. Carmen Hickerson from GLI, Representative Steve Riggs, and WFPL political editor Philip Bailey. Thank you.
Thanks, Gabe.
All right, and when we come back on Byline on WFPL News, a look at the Ark Encounter theme park, what's next, and what may or may not be happening with it. It's Byline from WFPL News. I'm Gabe Bullard. In just a minute, we're going to hear more about a prescription drug that's devastating communities in southern Indiana. But first, most people tend to call it the Ark Park. The Ark Encounter theme park is a proposed attraction planned for Grant County. With me now is Joe Sonka from Leo Weekly. You've been chronicling this park really since its inception. And first of all, let's just start from the beginning. What is this park? Tell us about it.
It is a recreation of Noah's Ark, built really the brainchild of Answers in Genesis and Ken Ham, their CEO, who, of course, are known for the famous Creation Museum in mm-hmm. northern Kentucky. And what they're planning to do is rebuild Noah's Ark and turn this into a huge theme park that they expect millions of people to come to every year.
Now, and in rebuilding Noah's Ark, and for people who have read up on the Creation Museum and on this project as well, the two of every animal story is told, but some animals will be on the Ark that maybe certain people don't expect.
Yes, there will be dinosaurs on the Ark, because according to Ken Ham and his ministry, the Earth is 6,000 years old, and humans used to ride on the back of saddled dinosaurs and caravans through the desert. So it's very it's a very unique perspective on history and science.
So this will be a very large replica of the Ark. We'll be able to walk in and yes. see, you know, the lions and the tigers and the dinosaurs.
And the T-Rexes, yes. Yeah.
And so this project is planned. It's a very expensive project.
Yeah, originally it was supposed to be about a $150 million project, and they were supposed to break ground on it last spring. But they've run into very sluggish fundraising. I went to a meeting in Williamstown in Grand Canyon where this is going to be built last August, and Mike Zovath from Answers in Genesis was saying that they had raised $100 million. They had almost raised it all, and they were telling citizens there that the streets were about to be paved in gold. Basically. But as the year went on, the fundraising, their little fundraising meter was kind of stuck on $4 million. And eventually they announced this year that they're going to have to do it in phases. And the total cost of the first phase will be about $73 million. But I went to the Creation Museum for a little preview that they put on for Ark Encounter last weekend. And they are a very long way from getting the money that they need even to break ground. They're $22 million away from only being able to break ground and $44 million away from the total amount of money that they will need to actually build the Ark. So whereas they once were expecting a spring 2014 opening, this could be as late as 2016 based on the time estimates that they gave.
For the opening of the first phase?
Yes.
And what is in the first phase?
The first phase will be the boats, and it will be three layers on the boat that will show Noah's family caring and feeding for all of the animals. And there will also be festive things, a parade of animals, where people dressed up as the animals going on the boat will have a parade where they describe it as having a world music and dancing and music. And meanwhile, actors dressed as pagans will be heckling Noah as he gets onto the boat. So that's what they have planned for their first pitch, but they're still quite a ways away.
And how are they going about raising this money? Are they just approaching wealthy donors? Are they soliciting online? How's this working?
Yeah, it's a mixture of funds that Answers in Genesis is raising and also private investors who are giving to the LLC, Ark Encounter LLC. And right now, at the preview, they said that they were trying to get investors to give $100,000 minimum in order to have part ownership of the park. And they were saying that, and their materials that they gave out were saying that people after 10 years would get a 20% return on their investment. So that's they're trying to get as much money as they can from private investors, but it's taking much longer than anyone thought it would, they thought it would.
And there is some state assistance coming in here as well.
Well, there was $43 million in state tax incentives that were potentially available for them, but one of the key parts of that is they're only rebated 25% of what they spend on construction by the spring of 2014. And based on the time estimates that they gave this weekend, they might not even break ground by that time. So if that's the case, then they actually won't get any rebates, tax rebates from their sales tax. But the state has already allocated $2 million towards road infrastructure improvement around the exit towards Williamstown. So they're doing this because, you know, their estimates say that millions of people are going to be coming here. And so $2 million has already been allocated, and there's a potential for $9 million more to actually improve the utilities and the roads going to the park, which is basically just empty land right now.
And you mentioned, you know, they're estimating that millions of people will be coming. Where do those numbers come from?
Well, they come from, first of all, it was a feasibility study done by someone who actually is a co-author of two of Ken Ham's books. And the state, actually, the tourism cabinet actually did another feasibility study, I guess it was last spring, when they were finally accepted for the tax incentives. And they had lower estimates, but they still also said that there would be many, many people coming here and that they would need improvements for that road for all the people, but that's a ways away.
And how has the Creation Museum been going? Is it the tourist attraction that it was sold as at first? Is this drawing in folks from out of state?
Well, it is drawing in people. Last year, they had pretty low attendance based on their other years. They had about 280,000 people, but it was packed when I went there Saturday. So they're still making plenty of money.
And I want to return to this idea of the tax incentives, and if they were not to get those, if because of the delays, they didn't get this any sort of favors from the state beyond the road work. Would that calm some of the controversy around this whole thing, since there was the constitutional question earlier?
Yeah, there was the constitutional question, but there's still the question of whether this is giving the state of Kentucky a black eye, that we're people, you know, laugh at us from around the country and say that we're backwards. And for the governor to, you know, proudly stand behind this project, which is telling people that 6,000 years ago, a 600-year-old man herded T-Rexes onto a giant boat. It's kind of embarrassing for the state.
Do you think this park will actually get built, given the delays it's facing?
I'm guessing that it won't, but based on what we saw yesterday at Chick-fil-A, you never know how many people are going to file into a place for reasons that we might not agree.
All right. Joe Sonka from Leo Weekly. The story is Investors of the Lost Ark. It is in this week's edition of Leo. Joe, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Gip.
All right. Every year, bingo fans, barbecue aficionados, and political junkies flock to the Fancy Farm Picnic. This is the most watched church picnic in all of Kentucky for one main reason: the annual display of political speechifying and stumping that happens. But this year, the bingo room may be a bit more interesting than the stage. With me to talk about this is Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Kenny Colston. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, thanks for having me. And I should add that the bingo room is usually the hottest spot on the picnic, even when they are doing the speeches. So bingo will still be good to go this weekend at Fancy Farm.
But not quite the political speeches.
No, not quite the political speeches. Although it seems like a lineup that is usually set weeks in advance is still in flux. Just got word before, coming on here with you that Secretary of State Alison Lundergan Grimes will be the only Democratic statewide official that is going to speak at the picnic. Originally, her, Attorney General Jack Conway, Auditor Adam Edlin, of course, Governor and Lieutenant Governor, were all going to skip the picnic. And when it comes to U.S. Senators, only Mitch McConnell will speak, as U.S. Senator Rand Paul is skipping the picnic. So a lot of the normal big names, even in an off year for statewide or big elections, usually they come. This year they're not.
Why are they skipping?
Well, there's a bunch of different reasons. U.S. Senator Rand Paul says that he's got a family commitment with his sons. A lot of people kind of think that the Democrats are skipping to distance themselves from President Barack Obama, who's unpopular in Kentucky. They don't want to get up there and defend the president and have that be used against them in future races or this year, or not defend the president and, you know, hurt liberal bases in Louisville or Lexington. So they're just avoiding it. That's what a lot of observers seem to think. But all of them have different things. I mean, the governor's over in Europe, economic development trip. Lieutenant Governor Abramson says he has a family event. The auditor, the attorney general, say they have prior commitments, and Grimes for a while said that she had a prior commitment as well. So it's really going to shape up to be a really local Fancy Farm. But that's still important, because those local races are likely to play in the big narrative this year when it comes to politics, which is, can Democrats hold the state house?
And what are the ramifications, though, of all these elected officials skipping this significant event in Western Kentucky?
Well, it definitely means they're going to have to shore up that far western base in future years. If Adam Edelin, you know, if he has a strong challenge and if he runs for re-election as auditor or runs for another office, Jack Conway, who's rumored to be a front runner for the 2015 governor's race, who, you know, has some roots in Western Kentucky, kind of around the Union, Owensboro area. But a lot of people think he really has to shore up his rural base. So he'll have some questions to answer as well. I actually think that this whole thing, it'll hurt you for future years. Maybe the reason why Grimes has changed her mind and decided to speak at the picnic. A lot of people see her as having a big future, possibly running against McConnell in 2014. being in the mix somewhere for 2015 other than her current office. So I think she's realizing, hey, you know, I'm still relatively new. I have to shake hands down here, because in that area, it's not as big of a TV market as other areas of the state. And those people really do put a kind of a they make sure that their politicians come down and shake their hands and look at them face to face. And they use Fancy Farm to do that.
And what is the political benefit, though, say, of possibly the governor not being there? You know, he's not being tied necessarily to the president's policies. But, I mean, is he really losing out by not going this time?
Well, you know, Steve Beshear, you would a lot of people seem to think that he's at the end of his political career unless he decides to do something crazy like run for U.S. Senate in 2014 or 2016, which a few people have mentioned. But I don't know that it is necessarily likely right now. He's at the end of his term. He's got a political legacy, two-term governor. I don't know that him personally it affects a lot. It hurts the organization. It hurts the event more than anything else when the governor decides to skip an event like Fancy Farm that is so big in the state of Kentucky. You can't do that anywhere else. And really nationwide, there's no annual bipartisan speaking event as big as Fancy Farm is. So it hurts the reputation of the organization of the event. But for Beshear personally, I don't think it does a lot of damage. But, you know, for the Obama argument, I don't know how much that really plays for a lot of the Democrats as why they're skipping. I think that's the fallback that people seem to think as to why. It can really hurt someone like Jerry Abramson if he wants to run statewide, or Jack Conway if he wants to run statewide, because they will upset those people down there for at least a year.
Now, this is a presidential election year, and earlier it had been confirmed that the Romney campaign was going to be sending someone. The first time in, 20 years? It was Al Gore, when he was running for vice president, spoke at Fancy Farm in 1992. But now the Romney campaign isn't sending anyone. It's Senator McConnell.
That's correct. There were a few names out there, Florida Agriculture Commissioner, Agriculture Commissioner from Texas, U.S. Senator from Nebraska, and they were all rumored to come speak as a Romney surrogate. But usually surrogates are high-profile names. A U.S. Senator would be considered a good surrogate, but another Agriculture Commissioner wouldn't really be considered a high-profile surrogate, someone who's really speaking on behalf of Mitt Romney. And I think at the end of the day, Romney's going to win Kentucky easily. There's really no reason to send someone like a Rob Portman or anybody who might be on the short list or be considered a high-profile surrogate. And at the end of the day, you know, Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Republicans in the U.S. Senate. He's the minority leader. It's really hard to get someone higher profile than that to speak as a surrogate. So I just think the Romney campaign and Kentucky GOP officials just said, listen, Senator McConnell is going to be there. He's higher than anybody we could pull from out of state. Let's just nominate him as the surrogate.
And it's clear why President Obama would not be sending anyone. As you mentioned, Kentucky is well expected to go red this year. But what is the benefit for even having Senator McConnell speak in Mitt Romney's favor?
Well, the idea is basically allows Senator McConnell to keep on his messaging, to assure it, just to beat up on Democrats is what it is. You know, the Kentucky Republicans, whether they're running for state house or U.S. Congress, they're all going against the president. And with Fancy Farm, all the TVs are going to be there. I will be there at Fancy Farm. All the newspaper writers, radio, TV, KET covers it live. So basically it allows Mitch McConnell to go basically in front of every news outlet in the state, or almost every news outlet in the state, and deliver another attack. And Republicans probably guessed that no one was going to speak on behalf of Obama. So it's just kind of a free press, a free attack, not only on the president, but of any Kentucky Democrat this year.
You also mentioned that this does something to slightly tarnish the reputation of the organization around Fancy Farm. Is the picnic really what it once was as far as a political event in Kentucky in this crucial time?
You know, I think it's had better years. I think organizers would admit that through no fault of their own. I mean, they can't force politicians to come. It's a church picnic that politicians kind of, quote unquote, invaded. But, you know, at the end of the day, they can't make sure the politicians come. They can't do any of that. Democrats seem to think they might be turning a little Republican because the area is turning Republican. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think in 14 with McConnell, in 15 with statewide races, in 16, Fancy Farm will make a return. It will be great years, those years. We're just kind of in lull years.
So we may just have to tough it out this year and next year and not get quite the fireworks that we're used to.
Right. Just save those fireworks up for 14, 15, and 16.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Are you fancy, huh? Are you fancy, huh? Are
you fancy, huh? Are you fancy, huh? From small towns to big cities, prescription painkiller abuse is getting worse. In the U.S., more people now die each year from pill overdoses than car accidents. And between 1999 and 2008, the number of deaths from drug poisoning tripled. WFPL's Erica Peterson visited one community ravaged by overdoses of the latest popular pill.
To the uninitiated, Austin, Indiana doesn't look like a town under siege.
We'll go up here, just keep going. We're going to go kind of the edge of town, keep going straight.
That's Jeremy Stevens. He and Jeff Basham lead me on a tour of their former drug haunts. I'm driving, because neither man wants his car to be recognized.
Right here, all of these houses. I bought drugs at every house you're looking at here, too. Every single one of them.
In the maze of back roads off the city's main drag, the houses are close together. Some look run down, others are well kept. But Stephen says many of these homes are inhabited by people who abuse and deal prescription painkillers.
I've seen the mother and the father go to the doctor. You know, it's a big day. It's like a festival. Everybody's over at the house waiting on them to get back from the doctor and the pharmacy. They come in with their four or five different narcotics. Nothing wrong with them at all physically. And then those narcotics are gone within 30 minutes.
Both Stevens and Basham have gone to jail for drug abuse. They're clean now, they say, but their community isn't. For the past year, the drug of choice has been Opana, a prescription painkiller. It's gotten so bad that Indiana State Trooper Jerry Gooden calls it an epidemic. But he says it's not limited to Indiana.
This is a problem that is across the whole United States of America. And if you don't think that it's a problem in the little community or the little burg or the big city that you live in, then you're living with your head in the sand.
Opana is legitimately prescribed to deal with chronic pain. The FDA approved the drug in 2006, but it wasn't until 2010 that Scott County began to see problems with Opana. That year, Purdue Pharma reformulated the popular and widely abused painkiller OxyContin. The new recipe made it harder to crush the drug and inject or snort it. When addicts couldn't abuse OxyContin anymore, they turned to Opana, which is much more potent. In Scott County, 31 people have died since last year because of Opana overdoses.
The majority of these deaths that we're seeing now are accidental deaths where people just don't know enough about the drug.
Kevin Collins is the Scott County coroner, and he owns a funeral home. Over the past year, overdoses have doubled his caseload.
Matter of fact, so much so that as a funeral director, I had a young man that was killed in an automobile accident, and I suggested to the family that they put in the newspaper that he was killed in an automobile accident so people didn't assume that he died from a drug overdose.
Some pill addicts buy the drugs on the street or steal them. But others have legitimate prescriptions, and some get hooked on the pills while using them to treat chronic pain. Scottsburg family practitioner Shane Avery says over the past decade, it seems medical philosophy has shifted.
I think at the issue of the heart of the matter is we've gotten people trained to look for answers to life's problems at the bottom of a pill bottle.
Avery prescribes pain medication, too. He requires random urine tests and pill counts to make sure patients are the ones taking the medication. He also uses a state database that lets doctors cross-reference patients to see if they're getting pills from other physicians. But these checks are optional.
12, 5103, 1290.
This leaves Austin Police Chief Donald Spicer performing triage after many in his community have already become addicted to the pills.
Hi there. How's everybody? Thing quiet?
Spicer is driving the streets of Austin, looking for anything amiss. His small police force has ramped up street patrols to try to control the drug problem. Community groups, like the local CEASE partnership, hold monthly meetings to try to help.
Well, today is the official launch of CEASE's very first website.
But perhaps the biggest tool in their fight came earlier this year. Opana manufacturer Endo Pharmaceuticals reformulated the drug. Today, it's difficult to find one of the original pills in Scott County pharmacies. The new pills are nearly impossible to crush and thus harder to abuse. Law enforcement is hopeful the reformulation will immediately reduce overdoses. But April Rivero with the National Coalition Against Prescription Drug Abuse says that won't solve addiction problems.
It is just becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and
despite our best work and that of a lot of other agencies and nonprofits and alliances and whatever out there, it just seems to continue.
And as addicts moved from OxyContin to Opana, Indiana State Trooper Jerry Gooden says now they'll look for a new drug. Already, the area has seen an increase in heroin use.
We'll take our chances. We've been battling cocaine. We've been battling acid. We've been battling marijuana for years. We've done our best to do it. We've not completed the battle. Obviously, we still fight it, but it's a lot less of a problem than what these pain pills have caused us.
As I leave Gooden's office, there's a worried-looking woman sitting outside. Later, Gooden calls me and says she was desperate for advice. The problem? One of her relatives is addicted to Opana. Erica Peterson, WFPL News.
It's Byline from WFPL News, and you can hear that story again on WFPL.org. Prescription pill abuse, of course, is also a problem in Kentucky, and you can see our ongoing coverage of that issue also on WFPL.org. Search on prescription pills. And we were talking about Fancy Farm earlier in the segment. You can catch all of our Fancy Farm coverage Saturday afternoon. That event will be live on KET as well. But you can follow Kenny Colston's coverage from Fancy Farm on Twitter as well. He is at KPR Frankfurt. Just ahead on Byline, I get all of my music opinions from the comments on Skrillex YouTube videos, but we have a pro coming in, Jeffrey Lee Puckett from the Courier-Journal. That's in just a minute on Byline.
Jim Morrison? He's a drunken buffoon, posing as a poet.
I like the Doors.
Give me the Guess Who. Come on, they got the courage to be drunken buffoons, which makes them poetic. Give me some White Light, White Heat. Iggy Pop! Amen! I should put this on. This isn't on your playlist,
Lester,
either.
Don't you think it's a little bit early for that?
Not for me.
It's Byline. I'm Gabe Bullard, and that was Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs, the godfather of rock criticism. And I'm here now with WFPL arts reporter Aaron Keene and another purveyor of fine music writing, Jeffrey Lee Puckett from the Courier-Journal. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gabe. Thanks, Aaron. It's a pleasure.
And congratulations are in order for you, Mr. Puckett. You have been at the CJ since 1990, and this year you will receive the Governor's Award in the Arts in the Media category.
I've been doing music since 1990. My first year at the CJ was actually 85.
Oh.
When I did youth sports.
Youth sports.
I did do youth sports, yes.
T-ball and such.
Yeah, right.
Pee-wee
into
football.
It was a transition into rock and roll for sure.
Well, you've actually been a music critic since. Well, I have here a copy of the Seneca High School Sentinel from 1978. This is a record review by Jeff Puckett, The Babies, First Class Music. This is The Babies' second album, Broken Heart, which you say firmly establishes them as one of the best bands in the country. Do you stand behind that?
I completely stand behind that. I don't know how anyone could argue with that.
I loved reading this because in between all of the sort of, you know, high school critical writing, there are still some hints of Jeffrey Lee Puckett's passion for music as we've come to know him. But I have to say, a pounding beat and urgent vocals make Give Me Your Love one of the album's best cuts. Lightly seasoned with some nice keyboard and guitar work, this song could hold its own against any Bad Company tune. Still a useful barometer?
I used that barometer in a review this morning,
oh,
as a matter of fact. I did.
Excellent.
The yardstick of Bad Company can never go out of style.
Well, so you've been doing this for quite a while, and
yes.
Especially since 1990 when you took over the music gig at the Courier. How has the face of music journalism changed? I mean, the industry has changed a lot.
Oh, yeah. It's sweeping changes. I mean, from the record labels, major labels controlling everything to almost completely falling apart to the rise of downloadable, stealable music to the internet, to blogs, which has been huge.
Well, so how does that affect your kind of daily, day-to-day work?
Well, I mean, there are more, you're expected to be in more media. You're expected to do, you know, it's not just print anymore, obviously. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change anything about how I approach writing at all. I mean, it's the same on a blog as it is, you know, in the paper. But it's there is some pressure, you know. Somehow these bloggers with no credentials have become so important that it puts pressure on print journalists to be more with it, and I'll do some air quotes there. so that's the part that's been frustrating for me, is I see a lot of writers on the internet who have no business doing what they're doing, but it still has an effect on everyone because you just have to keep up. You have to learn about Skrillex, for God's sake. You know?
Well, how do you maintain those credentials? How do you flaunt those credentials to make it clear that, you know, your review is something that has that extra degree of thought to get people into it?
I think you should make it obvious with the writing. I mean, that's where it begins and ends. It should never be a question for anyone. I mean, if you should write, I think people online sometimes, they just don't put as much thought into things. It's just, you know, you'll see posts. This was posted at 3:48 a.m. And you just know they're hammered and they're just going to write whatever they want to write. And I can't do that. You know, I have everything that is going to be read by someone has to be as good as I can make it. And I think eventually that develops just a body of work that people can count on. So that's what I go for.
Has it also sped up your timeline? I mean, bloggers can bloggers will review an album 3 months before it's officially released,
right?
Just
yeah.
because they have it in their hands.
Yeah.
Does that then open the door for you to be able to review it if you have there even before it drops, or do you still stay fairly faithful to that kind of traditional media PR release date kind of?
Yeah,
schedule?
I think it's important to stay traditional for the artist's sake, because if you write about something that can only be stolen at that point, then if you're wild about the record, you know, theoretically, the artist is going to lose even more sales if someone says, oh, I think I'll buy that. So I prefer to write about it the week it's released, or maybe the week after,
okay,
so that people can buy it, you know, legally.
So you're not as concerned about being first as you are about kind of respecting the process?
No. You know, for a long time, reviews at the Courier, they would sometimes run 3 weeks after release. And I kind of like that because it gave you a chance to sort of soak it up. You know, because some records you don't, the first couple of times you listen to them, they just don't, for whatever reason, connect with you. But I definitely understand that it's better to get it within the first 5 to 8 days, I think, is important. I think that's still soon enough.
Well, we were talking about how in Almost Famous, our fake Lester Bangs, Philip Seymour Hoffman, telling fake Cameron Crowe that to be careful when writing about musicians. You know, he's like, they're going to make you want to feel like you're their friend, but you're not their friend. does that happen to you? Do you have those kind of those boundary issues when you're writing about musicians that you also happen to know on a personal level?
It is a worry at times. Because we all live in Louisville here. We know what this town is like. My neighborhood has probably a dozen musicians in it, you know. And I have been friends for years with some of the people who I write about regularly. And to this day, I'm uncomfortable about reviewing my Morning Jacket concerts. Because I have to really make myself take a step back and not enjoy something that I know is maybe a little bit of an inside joke, some little aside by Jim or whatever. I have to just step back and say, all right, I got to be really firm about this. And if he's not singing too well, I have to mention that his voice sounds kind of off or whatever. I've never felt that it was a huge problem, though. The only time it's ever a really big problem is when someone I like puts out an album that's not very good.
Yeah.
usually then I will conveniently get very, very busy, and I won't have time to comment on that particular release.
Do you think there's an understanding, you know, you mentioned if you're going to say that Jim James' singing is a little bit off, an understanding that if he reads that, he'll understand that it's not some sort of personal thing, that it is, you know, you being the objective reviewer?
Well, the best musicians, I think, they want me to be honest. And that's been mentioned to me in conversation a few times. They're like, I know you're not going to blow smoke, and we appreciate that. So that is kind of frees me up a little bit to know that the next time I have a barbecue, it's not going to get ugly.
Well, you mentioned having to kind of stay on top of the game a lot to know about things like Skrillex, even if dubstep is really just far outside of your interest and perhaps your readerships as well.
Right.
So with the internet and everyone's a critic, does that make you have to? Does that dictate somewhat your coverage as far as like your you know, what one role the critic has historically played has been of gatekeeper, of saying I am not going to cover that because that's part of the criticism. Mm-hmm. Like that's not, you know, I'm not going to give that my attention. But do you find yourself having to, and you write for a newspaper too, which has a general interest readership.
Right.
So you have to write about things that you might not normally care that much about, at least as much about as the baby's second record.
Yeah. that can be tough / annoying to deal with stuff that I have zero interest in. But also it's part of the learning process, which never ends in any kind of writing, but especially I think with music writing, because you just have to know what's going on. So if I'm forced to spend an afternoon going through Skrillex's catalog on Spotify, then at least I can definitely say, this is not good. You know, I don't appreciate what this guy's doing, but it gives me context, which is just all important. You can see, I mean, and then you can even hear elements. You're like, oh, well, there's a little bit of Donna Summer in there. That's kind of cool. But overall, I just will never listen to this again.
Well, we've had conversations before about which bands and which acts out there have the most faithful defenders in the public.
Right.
Has any of that changed? Are Toby Keith fans still the most passionate about defending their having their boys back?
They're the most physical, let's say. Country music fans in general are the most vocal. Okay. I don't know if they're more passionate, but they're definitely the most vocal. And classic rock fans.
Mm.
Modern, I mean, I don't know if I've ever had hate mail from an indie rock guy.
Do they just reblog you and write their own snarky commentary?
That's probably true, yeah. which I avoid. But I've never had one, you know, accost me with a white belt at Kroger or anything like that. But yeah, classic rock fans are because a lot of them are kind of, and this is not being snarky, a lot of them are locked into that era.
Yeah.
They just never had no reason to go on and listen to Pavement or REM or anything, you know, from say 1980 onward.
Mm-hmm.
So that is their music. And if you say something bad about that period or their favorite band, God forbid, then they're going to be really upset.
Ah.
One thing, and Aaron touched on this a little bit, the great thing and not so great thing about the advent of the internet in the news industry or in media is that it sort of made everyone a competitor that, you know, we're competing with places in other states elsewhere for writing, for getting stories out and all of that. And so at the same time that you're writing still for the Courier-Journal audience, for the people who are reading it in print and on the website, you're also, your pieces are available to the folks who might be out reading Pitchfork or
right.
who would subscribe to Rolling Stone. So how has that changed your approach to what you cover to how you cover it?
It hasn't really changed it that much. I like to think that I keep up pretty well with what's going on. Not 100% because it's just because of other changes in the media. You don't have as much time as you once did. For example, today, you know, I had a huge story about the Maltese Falcon, which has zero to do with music, but had to be done. I think the good part is it keeps you on your toes. The bad part, like I mentioned before, is the feeling that you have to be kept on your toes, or is there going to be some kind of consequences? I like having a readership that is now everywhere. I mean, I get emails from people in Wisconsin who said, hey, I saw what you wrote about Barry Manilow. I had one last week. I saw what you wrote about Barry Manilow. I just wanted to say, right on, man. All right, buddy. So that's kind of neat. You know, it's just, I think it's, you know, search engines are the, what do you get when you get the alert?
The Google alert.
The Google
yeah.
alert.
Yeah, your ears are burning.
It's really, really definitely changed things.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey Lee Puckett from the Courier-Journal. Congratulations on the award as well.
Thank you, sir.
All right. And WFPL Arts reporter Aaron Keene. That's all the time we have on Byline. Thanks for joining us. The show is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. More information is online at WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.